Attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's webinar. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEP and glad to have you with us today. Today's webinar is just one aspect of a collaboration between SNEB and the Mediterranean Diet Roundtable. It's also a preview of the content of the Mediterranean Diet Roundtable conference in May, where SNEB has been invited to present. At the close of the webinar, you'll have a chance to learn more about the roundtable diet event, as well as the discount that's available to SNEB members to attend that. So as we get started, if you look in your GoToWebinar tool panel, you'll see two handouts for today's presentation. One are the slides that so you can download that, take notes and follow along. The other is a scientific article that Dr. DeVivo has made available for you as a reference. We will take questions at the end of the webinar, so please type those in the question block so we can moderate those to our presenter. There'll be a short survey when I close out the webinar, and we'd appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as ideas on future webinars. And then watch for an email. We'll probably try to get that out by the end of the day on Friday. That'll include the link to the recording, the handout material, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning with your attendance today. So we have with us today as our moderator, Michelle Brill. Michelle is the chair-elect of the FNEE division, who is co-sponsoring this webinar along with the communications division. Michelle is the FCHS educator and associate professor at Rutgers Cooperative Extension of Mercer County.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Welcome, everybody. I'm happy to introduce Dr. DeVivo. Dr. Immaculato DeVivo is Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. DeVivo is an international leader in the area of molecular and genetic epidemiology of cancer. Her research focuses on how the environment interacts with genetic variants to influence susceptibility to hormonal cancers. Her laboratory focuses primarily on the discovery and characterization of genetic biological markers to assess disease susceptibility in human populations. Welcome, Dr. DeVivo.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Thank you, Rachel, for that wonderful overview of my presentation as well as MDR. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I feel like I'm on NPR. I love this. Rachel, can you do me a favor, please, and give me permission? Oh, there it is, to advance the slides. I have it. Thank you. So I guess I will start. I would like to, today in my presentation, unless, Danny, are you also speaking
yes.
first or last?
No, I'm speaking last.
Okay. I would like to, before I present the actual data, I would like to just give the basic rationale for undertaking this study. I am, as you know from my name, I was born in Italy, even though I was raised in the United States by a very Italian mom, and was weaned and raised on the Mediterranean diet, which I like to consider not really a diet, but a pattern of eating, which is really a plant-based diet. For the most part, there was a study that had come out a New England Journal by Dr. Miguel Martinez, who is one of the esteemed panelists at the MDR meeting in May, who showed in a randomized trial the benefits of the Mediterranean diet on primary cardiac prevention, cardiac issue prevention. And that randomized trial really spurned in me this idea of wanting to look at this diet at the bench, at the DNA level, because this is where my expertise is in. And that's where I bring in telomeres. So a few years ago, given that I study cancer, this idea of looking at telomeres, which are the ends of your chromosomes, became sort of an obsession for me because, as Michelle said in her introduction, I study the interplay between the genetics and your environment because I prefer to study those diseases for which there's a modifiable component. In this particular case, telomeres, which are the ends of the DNA, it's somewhat your environment, it can somewhat modify how they shorten or are affected over time. So without further explanation, I'd like to go into the presentation. And the presentation will give you, by way of background, what as most are often associate diet with a pyramid. This pyramid here is pretty, very specific to the Mediterranean diet, where again, it's the bottom is the foods that should be most plentiful in the diet, which is basically a plant-based diet for the most part. But it doesn't exclude animal products like cheese, yogurt, fish, poultry, et cetera, et cetera. It just limits the quantity. So the telomeres, the best way for me to explain what telomeres are, which are these repetitive DNA sequences, TAAGG, at the end of your chromosome. So if you picture your chromosome, the inside, the middle of the chromosome from the centromere and then distal to the telomeres, this is where all the genetic information or the most important parts of the gene-making machinery are located. The telomeres are the ends, and the role of telomeres is to really protect the chromosome in the way that shoelaces protect your shoelaces from becoming frayed. And that's what you can see here in that cartoon. You can see what happens when the little plastic clip comes off. Everything goes a bit awry. So in this cartoon here, in this slide, you'll see that the telomeres are in red, and the chromosomes, this is a metaphase of a chromosome. This is the chromosome actually undergoing a metaphase. The purple is the chromosome, and the reds are where your telomeres would be, and they really are there to protect and maintain the fidelity of the genetic information, okay, during replication. And without getting very detailed, and I will go through it in a couple of slides, there is a normal way of losing telomeres, and then there's ways above and beyond the normal machinery, which allows you to lose clear telomere DNA bases. So, but the role of the telomeres is, again, to protect your telomeres, to protect the genetic information, and to maintain genomic stability. Just by way of background, again, some of the nuts and bolts, as I like to say. So telomere length is actually something that's quite variable. The length can go anywhere from 8 to 12 kilobases from birth. So it's very variable, and there really isn't a normal. And that's one of the things that people grapple with when we give out telomere data, is that there isn't really a normal, because the normal is individual. It's me compared to me, because telomeres are, they have a very large genetic component, but as I said, they're very much influenced by the environment. So any individual, even siblings or even monozygotic twins, will have variation with respect to the length of their telomeres. So at about 100, if you can live that long, your telomeres are anywhere from 4 to 6. So the point of that is to show you that over time, your telomere length will shorten. This is a normal progression. Over time, your telomeres will shorten. And there's a reason for that. There's a normal biological reason for that. But the reasons why you have shortening over time is because you lose a little bit of your telomeres every time the DNA undergoes DNA replication. And that's because of the 3' lagging strand. And again, I'm not going to go into the details, but because this happens on the 3' lagging strand, where you lose a little bit as a result of replication, in non-somatic cells, where you have telomerase, the enzyme that maintains telomere length, the telomerase will go in and allow that bit that might be lost during replication to be filled in. Now, you need the enzyme telomerase to do that. And so cells that don't have telomerase will undergo constant shortening over time. And these cells are mostly somatic cells. Somatic cells are heart cells, lung cells, skin cells. non-germline cells. So sperm and stem cells, for instance, will have a lots of telomerase because you don't want germ cells or stem cells, progenitor cells, to be lacking in any length. So because of this phenomena where there's loss over time, enumerating your telomeres is akin to a molecular clock. And oftentimes you'll read in papers that someone's biological age is different from their chronological age. And they're referring to telomeres as well as methylation. And basically, everyone has had this experience where you see a 90-year-old woman or a man, and you say, wow, you know, they're 90, but they're fit, or they look like they could be 50. You know, this is that biological age. So inside, this person's biologically 50, but because of years, she's really 90. So this is some terms that you might actually run into when you hear about telomeres. So here in this cartoon, I wanted to just graphically display the fact that the first 20 years of life is when you lose a lot of your telomere ends. And this is partly because your first 20 years of life is when a person does its most growing. And again, if your cells are not dividing, you're not going to lose telomeres, because during DNA replication, you will lose some telomere in those cells that don't have telomerase. So that's the first 20 years of life. But you still continue to lose over time. It's not inconsequential. So the fact that you continue to lose in the ages where chronic disease comes in, this puts a person at risk for earlier onset of these chronic diseases. And therein lies the interest from a health perspective of why telomere shortening is so important. Because telomere shortened over time as a biological process, what we're interested in is accelerated telomere shortening above and beyond what should be expected with age. So I'm going to repeat that, because that's really a very take-home message that, yes, Dr. DeVivo, telomere shortened over time. That's a process that happens over as aging. But what we're interested in is accelerated aging. Aging that you should be getting these diseases in 90, not at 50. So that's where the interest from a public health and as well as clinicians and research scientists have really focused in on the understanding of accelerated telomere shortening. Okay, so I'm sorry, I'm getting, okay. So I wanted to, hold on a second. I'm having trouble with advancing the slides. Okay, so are we on the cellular responses slide, Rachel? Is that where we are next? So basically, if you look at the schematic, which I take from Wang et al., you see the consequence of short telomeres and what your cell would do in response to short telomeres. So you have checkpoints in your body that says, uh-oh, short telomeres, activate the checkpoints. And if that's the case, the cell will undergo proliferative arrest and hopefully apoptosis. So I'm reading the slide to you where checkpoint intact and apoptosis are on the left, my left. So an apoptosis is normal cell death, programmed cell death that the body has taken on to say, this is a bad cell, this is a bad egg, it's full of mutations, I need to get rid of it, because if I don't, I'm going to have a problem. I'm going to have a cancer, or I'm going to have something serious. So let's get this cell and get rid of it. That's normal apoptosis. But you could see what happens if under short telomere scenario where the checkpoints are bypassed. You could have chromosome fusion. You could have non-reciprocal recombination, all resulting in rampant instability, which is a hallmark of cancer. Again, the body has the option of undergoing cell death if all the checkpoints are intact. But in the case where this is not true and you have reactivation of telomerase, which remember I said in non-germ cells, telomerase is pretty much turned off late in gestation, you will get cancer. And telomeres really came as a result of understanding this anti-cancer hypothesis, which states that when a cell has been dividing for a long time, and every time you divide, the risk of accumulating errors is high, it should go away. It should die off. But in the case where you have telomerase, which is that enzyme which maintains telomere length, you could have a problem because now you have a cell that should normally be discarded in the circulation around with all these mutations. And again, as a cancer person, mutation is bad because it puts you at risk for cancer. So when you when we study telomeres, we use a blood sample. And the blood sample what we're looking at are the white blood cells, because this is where the DNA is. And one of the questions most often asked is, well, how does your blood telomere match up or correlate with the tissues in the body? For instance, in this diagram, we have skin, fat, and muscle. And you don't have to belabor the, and we did it with men and women. This is a paper done by my colleague, Abraham Avi Abraham, and you could see that it's pretty well correlated, that the blood lymphocytes or leukocytes, white blood cells, can capture or act as a proxy very well for what's going on inside the body. And you could see that the correlations are quite good. Even skin, the correlation is quite good. It has a steeper slope, but that just means skin rapidly divides, so you would expect that. But overall, there's a strong correlation between your blood lymphocytes and other tissues, which mean that you can assess telomere length just by taking a blood sample. You don't need to do a muscle biopsy or a fat biopsy or a skin biopsy. Okay, and this is an interesting slide because it shows you what a lot of people have believed, for, which a lot of people know and believe, or not just believe, but is proven, is that women live longer than men. The question is it because they have longer telomeres? So if you look across ethnicities, Danish, French, Flemish, for the most part, it's all white of European descent, women across the board have longer telomere lengths, independent of anything else, than men. And again, Avi Abraham, a colleague of mine, quantitated that, and on average, women have 150 base pair longer. Not only that, female infants are born with longer telomeres than males. Even more interesting was a study that we did not too long ago, which involved African Americans. So even with it, so African Americans have longer telomeres than whites, for sure, but even within African Americans, women African Americans have longer telomeres than male African Americans. So this is, again, just giving you the background of what we know about telomeres and their dynamics and how we would go about measuring them. So in the study population that I work in, which is a nurse's health study, a lot of people are familiar with this landmark population, which was founded in 1976 by Frank Spicer at the Nurses Health Study at Harvard Medical School. This is a population that has provided incredible insights across almost every disease, as well as wellness in science for the last 40 years. And I am very fortunate to be part of the Nurses Health Study, and we undertook this study in this particular sub-study within the main study to look at predictors of telomere length. So what is it in the environment and what genetics predict telomere loss or telomere maintenance or telomere lengthening? And because this telomeres can be influenced both by genetic and as well as environmental factors, this is a slam dunk, as we say. We can do this. So we know that some of the non-genetic predictors, meaning what affects your telomere length, we've shown and others have shown, just to give you an idea, being obese, smoking, air pollution, lack of sleep, lack of exercise, sedentariness. We've shown a lot of lifestyle factors, poor lifestyle factors that one can glean without me going through the whole litany of them to show that they have an impact on your telomere length. But there are also lifestyle factors that you can assume, or if you already have, that will benefit your telomere length or keep it from getting shorter. Because remember, telomeres shorten over time. The question is how fast you lose your telomeres, okay? So in this situation, in this study, we were looking not only at mechanisms, but we want to identify those modifiable factors, because here is a genetic entity that you can actually get a handle on, for the most, not entirely, but you can have an impact, let's put it that way. And so here in this very, well, I like to, you know, it's a cartoon, very, very simple cartoon. You could see that the telomeres in red, and as you go with age down, if you want to call it the y-axis, you'll see that the effect of stress will shorten it, smoking. And as you see the red shortening, you could assume that at the, by the very end, you would have some crisis go into effect. So the question, this particular question that I like to talk about today was, again, my fascination with the effects of the Mediterranean diet. And how does the diet or the foods within the Mediterranean diet work? As when I was doing interviews for CNN and Forbes, and I think it was 220 outlets that had gotten involved, they said to me, we already know that the Mediterranean diet is great. It's already been shown. What has your research shown? I said, well, I've given you the why and the how, basically. I'm telling you that the impact of this lifestyle diet is at the DNA level. It has a physiological effect that you can measure at the basic ATGC level. And so that was the question. And what I have not told you is that in addition to, which was on the slides, in addition to normal shortening as a result of cell replication, oxidative stress and inflammation, which again, some can attribute to normal body processes, but for the most part, a lot of oxidative stress and inflammation is a result of outside forces. The reason obesity and smoking impact your telomeres is because they are a major source of oxidative stress and they cause a lot of inflammation. So when you have oxidative stress and inflammation, it forces the telomeres to shorten that much longer. And it for the existence for oxidative stress, the reason that's the case is because when you have oxidative stress in these repetitive regions, it's not that the regions are different, you know, DNA is DNA, but because of this repetitive region that's very high in these bases, what happens is that they're less likely, so when you suffer an impact in these sequences, the body is less apt to be able to repair it. It impacts the repair capacity, and that's been shown. So the problem is then you have regular cell replication on top of which you add oxidative stress, and then on top of that, you add inflammation, and you have a real toxic cocktail to your telomeres. So you go from normal shortening of possibly 50 base pair a year to like 200 base pairs a year. And that over time adds up very quickly, almost geometrically in some cell types. So we know that the Mediterranean diet, we know that it is full of antioxidants, the foods, the fruits, vegetables, the legumes, the nuts, and the olive oil are jam-packed with antioxidants and anti-inflammatory factors. So telomere shortening is the marker of biological aging, and we know it's accelerated by oxidative stress and inflammation. So that is what I've been saying. And now we want to understand the adherence to this diet. Is it associated with keeping your telomeres intact, or is it associated with longer telomeres? Because a longer telomere would suggest, in a very general sense, a marker of good health and good aging. And we did it in US women. And again, the Nurses Health Study Design, it's a prospective cohort, so it's a longitudinal study where you follow people over time, and as they get diseased, you sort of take them out of the main cohort, but you follow them in sub-studies. It started in 1976, it's still ongoing. It started out with 121,000 women between the ages of 30 and 55, and in 1989, these women were asked to give blood. 32,000 agreed, and this is the age range for that, 43 to 69. And then for those who did not want to give blood, they gave a cheek cell sample. So we have a lot of DNA on these women. Most women in the Nurses Health Study, we have some sort of biospecimen in which we can do biological assays. So if you look at this timeline here, in addition to the blood samples, we have data on every aspect of their lives, what they eat, what they don't eat, what sickness they have, what they don't have, what pills they take, what they don't, what they do, they go to church, do they exercise, do they have friends, are they widowed, are they divorced, every kind of life. I mean, just a rich data source. And the questionnaires are given out every 2 years, and they update them every 2 years. And so what we did was we took women who gave blood in 19, so to be available or to be eligible for this study, you had to have a blood sample or, again, a DNA sample. But for this case, we were able to get blood. All the women had blood. And then we looked at the questionnaire to see if we could derive from the questionnaire whether or not they followed a Mediterranean diet pattern of eating. And the number there is correct. We have 13,000 women to do this with. That's statistically very robust, as they say in my business. So the way we measure telomere length is not through a southern blot, which is a typical way of measuring telomere length. Southern blot is not amenable to high throughput studies like we have, population studies, because it requires a lot of DNA, 10 micrograms, where telomere measurements using a qPCR, we're talking on the order of 5 nanograms, log scales less, basically. And we also have a finite source. A lot of these women only gave one blood sample, two at the most, and we don't have any more to get. Some of them are just are unable to give, or they could even be dead at this point. So we had to make the most we could with the blood samples that we had. So necessity's mother of invention. I was forced to optimize this qPCR method, which we did, and we have papers in 2007 to show that we could do this with very little DNA. So the technique, qPCR, is very standard molecular biology technique. It's a way of measuring expression, and it's real time. The only thing we did in my lab was we optimized it for a high throughput setting using minimal amounts of DNA, using a different kind of a platform, and using robotics to get it done. And we used a computational Z-score to actually do the statistics. So the score itself is a score that we used that Dr. Antonia Trikopoulou, I don't want to use the word invented, but derived. She is the mother of the Mediterranean diet, as she'll be at the meeting in May. I can tell you that a half hour or an hour with Antonia, you feel like you've been with the Dalai Lama with respect to Mediterranean diet, because her words are so, she has the most influence in the world, in my view, on the Mediterranean diet, because she's given her whole life on this topic. So she came up with this scoring plan. So basically, to be very clear, the components are vegetables, whole grains, fish, oil, fruits and vegetables, legumes, and then there's also meat. So what you do is you create a median in your population. For every time someone eats above the median, let's say a fruit, they get a point. If they eat and there's also, red meat is at a minimum here. You don't want to have too much red meat. So if someone eats, you're allowed to eat the median amount of red meat, but if you eat more than the median, you get no points. You don't get points taken off because it's not a putative score. So you can, the highest you can get with Antonia's score is a 9. That is being perfect across the board with the consumption of Mediterranean diet, all at or below the, at or above the median. And I was fortunate enough to know her husband, Demetrius Trikopoulou, also a figure larger than life in the field. And he always would say to me that the problem with the wine is that you should never drink it before or after the meal. It only works, he would say, if you drink the wine with your meal. So I don't make a big deal about wine because people have, there's personal reasons for wine or no wine, but I bring it up because it's part of the score, but it doesn't really impact the score in any way. So zero, the higher you are, the closer you are to the Mediterranean diet. And so these are the results. After 13,000 eligibilities, we were able to get complete data on close to 5,000 women. And again, here you have the score. So the woman with the highest score was a 6. In our population, no one reached a 9. 6 was about the highest we could get, with very good numbers to do any kind of statistics. And if you see there, the top panel is an age-adjusted correlation or association, and the other is multivariable adjusted. Basically, what that means is if you took out all the confounders, such as BMI, things that impact your telomeres, if you adjust for all that, the association is very strong. The association with having a high score on the Mediterranean diet and telomere length was 0.004. So how does that compare with other diets? Because that's a very important question. And one, probably one of the reasons why BMJ was very excited about this study. If you look at how the Mediterranean diet compares to, let's go with the worst case scenario, which is the Western diet, which would basically be, unfortunately, the American diet, white flours, burgers, French fries, and Coke, it's almost the opposite if you look at the graph. So in the x-axis below for diet score, you see with quintiles of length, with quintiles of food below and telomere length on the y-axis, you could see your telomeres get longer with the higher you score on your Mediterranean diet, where it's the opposite. You're losing telomere length with the more Western pattern of eating. And you compare it to Pruden. Pruden is better. Pruden would be like a very good low-fat diet, but it doesn't really have the quantity of nuts and olive oil and all the other good things that come in the Mediterranean diet. And alternative healthy AHEI basically incorporates food, but it also includes a lot of other lifestyle stuff. So the most comparable, if you had to go head-to-head, would be between the Mediterranean diet and the Pruden, and you could see that the Mediterranean diet is superior even to the Pruden in terms of impact on your telomere. So when we put this paper together in our group at the nurses, given that a lot of them are clinicians, they're interested in the translational impact, because if I tell you your telomeres are 200 base pairs longer than the person next door to you, what does that actually translate to from a public health standpoint? So we calculated that the difference in telomere length for each 1 point change, okay, so if you had a score of 3 and you went to 4, that corresponded to, on average, a year and a half of better, a year and a half more of life or aging or better aging. So the max that we saw was a 3 point change, which would increase to about, which would give you 4.5 years of aging. So these results show that those women had adhered, both obviously the ones who adhered the most to the Mediterranean diet, had longer telomeres than those who didn't. So it's not that it lengthened, it's just that those women that adhered to the diet were reaping the benefits of the diet. They weren't getting accelerated shortening, if any shortening at all. That we can't tell from this study because of the design. You'd have to set up a randomized trial for that, but I know the Spanish are doing that. Miguel Martinez will be at the meeting, another esteemed colleague and pioneer in the field of Mediterranean diet. He will be one of the panelists at MDR. We can ask him that. How is that randomized trial going? So the So we looked at the components of the Mediterranean diet, and we didn't see in this population any particular component being better than others. But I have the caveat is, aside from the fact that we believe it's the whole diet, the synergy that makes it as strong as it is with respect to impact on health impact and longevity, in this U.S. population, they can't actually compare at all. And we've done this comparison with either the Spanish or the Italian, because that's the data that we had, with respect to olive oil consumption and even legume consumption. So, and you'll hear from Miguel from Spain, Dr. Martinez, when he comes, in their work, they were able to show that really the olive oil and the nuts were a major component of the diet driving the beneficial effects. So within our population, because of in the US, the diet came late, let's call it late, to to being enculturated. We don't really have the data to show one particular component over the other, but we were able to show very strongly, statistically robustly, as you saw from the data, that the women who adhered to the diet had the longest telomeres compared to the other diets. So we concluded from that greater adherence to the diet is associated with longer leukocyte telomere length. We caveated in U.S. women because we've not done it anywhere else. And we know that the benefits are in promoting health and in longevity. The future direction would be to really conduct this kind of study in a true Mediterranean population, the Greek, the Italian, the Spanish, because we believe that the effects will be that much stronger. As I said, the olive oil consumption is 3 times more in the Mediterranean populations than in the nurses' health study. Oops, sorry, did I? Okay, I think, I'm sorry, my slides just advanced. Hello?
Oh, I have, yeah, we have. Hi. It, yeah, as I say, we have it here on the okay. Final slide.
Yes, I'm sorry. And with that, I'm sorry, there's a little delay with the slides. With that, I'd like to invite you all to come to MDR and listen not only to me, but to the esteemed panelists that have jumped. I mean, they couldn't have been quicker in responding to saying we want to be part of this dynamic event. Dr. Trocopoulou, the mother of the Mediterranean diet upon which all our scores are based, she derived them. We have Dr. Miguel Martinez, who authored and ran the landmark New England Journal paper on the trial, which had to be cut short because the randomized trial showing Mediterranean versus low fat on cardiac primary cardiac prevention. Then we have the esteemed Dr. Frank Sachs from Harvard, my colleague, who's not only done incredible work with the Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet, but all 4 of us will be there to give you our latest results and to address any question or future, and even possibly divulge new research that has not been published yet. To me, it is an honor not just to scientific chair this meeting, but to be there with them and to still and continue to learn from them, because they've spent the greater part of their research lives donating, contributing their time, energy, and brain power to understanding the effects of this diet, which are very powerful. So please join us May 15th and 16th at the Roundtable in Boston. We're having great weather now, so don't be afraid to come to Boston. Eventually, we also get good weather, despite what you might hear on the news channels. And listen not just to the panelists that bring you the scientific data, but Daniela, the founder of the MDR, who will speak in a few minutes. She will tell you that she's also brought on incredible experts in many of the areas related to Mediterranean diet and implementation and public health. And with that, I'll take any questions after Daniela speaks.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Dervivo. This was very inspirational. This is Daniela Puglielli, founder of the Mediterranean Diet Roundtable. And I'll just take only a few minutes to introduce you to this concept, inviting you to attend our gathering. What we heard from Dr. Dervivo was we are what we eat, right? We are what we eat. But also much more, the lifestyle, the ritual of the consumption, the buying behaviors, all have an influence on the public health, which is the goal, overall goal of people in the profession of nutritionists and dietitians, so to improve the general public health. And the Mediterranean Diet Roundtable is a way to discuss all those components, the scientific background with incredible stellar panelists of the leverage of Professor DeVivo, as well as specialists in speaking about the environment, how the choice food choices really impact the environment or the fair trade practice, recognizing of the importance of certain ingredients that are distinctive of certain cultures. So what happens, what effects has the Mediterranean diet on humans, as you heard, on a DNA level, as well as the stress level, the oxidative stress level, as well as trade and overall wellness for the society. Come to the MDR, be inspired, and network, connected with the outstanding panelists, and looking forward to welcoming you. If you have any question for Professor DeVivo, this is a good time to pose them.
So thank you, both of you, very much. That was incredibly informative. So I have two questions. The first one is, has anyone done a comparison with a low-carbohydrate diet?
That is a great question, and I think they have, and Frank Sachs would have all the data on that. I don't have that at my fingertips, but if you Google low-carb Mediterranean diet, I think they have done that. And I think they've done it from different perspectives for diabetics and for weight loss.
Okay, thank you. The next question is, can you please explain the role, good or bad, of telomerase?
That's a great question. I love that question. I was on a panel with Elizabeth Blackburn, who actually won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of telomerase. So the telomerase, not unlike everything else in life, is a double-edged sword, okay? Because once telomerase, the enzyme that maintains telomere length, now you're in my wheelhouse, Michelle. Once you the problem with telomerase is that in utero, it's on early in gestation, then it's turned off in somatic cells. And it has to be turned off in somatic cells because of the ability of mutation and carcinogenesis. So what I've always asked this question is that, oh, for short telomeres, it gives you cardiovascular disease and it shortens your life. Why can't we just give telomerase? You can't do that because what happens is when you give telomerase, you are turning on cells that are prone to cancer. So I didn't include the schematic here where how the whole scheme works when a cell goes from a highly proliferative one to a senescent one to then an apoptotic one. And if you escape apoptosis and you turn off checkpoints like P53 and retinoblastoma, you create a cell that goes dormant, basically asleep. And eventually, if a telomerase is given or turned on, that cell is long-lived. So that cell full of mutations will live on forever and put you at risk for cancer. So you would never give telomerase because you're putting that person at risk for cancer. And therein lies a double-edged sword because you say, oh, but telomerase is necessary for telomere length. Yes, but biologically it's turned off early in gestation. So, and another interesting fact is that if you look, this is an interesting fact. I teach this in one of my, there's a slide I have in one of my lectures that people are always amazed. The hallmark telomerase upregulation is found in 85 to 90% of all cancer cells. It's the hallmark. So the telomerase is involved in the cancer progression. It's that switching on. You need to let a cell die off when it's time to go. So that's the good and the bad. You need telomerase, but you have telomerase normally in your germ cells and in your stem cells. You just can't have it on in somatic cells, which have a high propensity to be mutated and go on to be cancerous.
Okay. Wow. Okay, questions are coming in. Let's see. Is there a point in aging at which changing to the Mediterranean diet is not going to be beneficial to telomere length? In other words, can switching to med diet overcome damage done by years of an unhealthy diet?
I would say yes. It's never too late. I'm a optimist. I think you can change at any time, and it's going to have some beneficial effect. We don't have the data to support that in my study because we did a longitudinal study. But I don't see any downside in eating the good foods in this diet and reaping all the benefits.
Well, that's good news. Okay, a couple questions about dairy. How would dairy be scored in the calculation? Would that be similar to red meat?
It's an interesting question, too. So basically, the dairy that they refer to in this Mediterranean diet is mostly yogurt, fermented versus non-fermented. So there is a difference, and Antonia will speak more to that. But typically, outside of childhood, most adults in Mediterranean countries don't eat that much milk. I mean, drink that much milk. They eat cheese and they eat yogurt, but these, again, they're different varieties and there's fermentation that's part of it. But it wouldn't be treated exactly like meat, but it's, you have to, yes, it's sparingly. Once or twice, I think there is a serving size. I don't have it in front of me right now, but maybe it, akin to 1 to 2 servings or 3 servings a week. But again, it's an interesting question because it's really related to ferment, like the yogurts and cheeses, as opposed to milk.
Okay. A question about the Mediterranean diet score. You control for calories in your regressions. Is the MD score a diet quality measure? Are the points allotted by being above the median in fruit quantity per 1,000 calories or just total fruit quantity?
It's total.
Total, okay. So there, the question then, if it is total, would, quote, overeaters have a higher score?
Very good question. And we didn't have, so this is, the truth is the nurses are very regulated. This is a criticism we have. They're not very generalizable because they're very regulated in their habits. We didn't have overeaters or anybody that we had to drop out because they were outliers. The typical caloric for these women were, I'm always surprised by it, but it's, you know, like 1600 calories a day or 1700. We didn't really have anything outside an outlier that would have made us throw them out because of, you know, because we do corrections and things. So we didn't really have overeaters per se. And this group again that followed, that participated, there weren't any real obese women or women that had any kind of so, you know, that's an interesting question. So, so if you're ticking off, you know, that goes into a bigger question of, you know, you have a group of women that are somewhat healthy to begin with. Mm-hmm. But it was total and it was calorie. Whoever asked this person is clearly a statistician, someone who knows statistics, and it was total calories, but it was also adjusted. So, yes.
Okay. How might swapping other healthy oils for olive oil impact this effect?
Another good question. They only looked at olive oil. So I don't have the data on other oils. But I know Miguel Martinez will have that in May.
And there are some concerns about the quality of the olive oil, particularly here in the U.S.?
That is something that I've learned as being part of this MDR experience. I learned last year in Beverly Hills, where we had a bunch of experts that make olive oil, that my understanding, and Daniela can explain better, that the quality of the oil here can never match the olive oil that comes from Mediterranean countries because of the environment under which it's grown, the soil, the nutrients. There are differences.
The way you extrude.
But I'm not, mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Daniela.
No, the way also you extrude the juice from the olives. So there are differences, if not in terms of taste per se, but in terms of polyphenols and other good ingredients, good elements that are going to be distinctive of certain olive oils. In Italy alone, we have such a variety from one place to another. You also have to consider right now California had a good winter with the water and everything, but they were dry for so long, and to manufacture, to produce olive oil, you need enough water. So it was not cost effective to manufacture olive oil in that part of the world. Although they share the same climate, California has the most Mediterranean climate in the United States compared to our side of the world. But still, the way you manufacture olive oil can greatly affect, have an effect on the final product, as much as the way you use olive oil, which is meant to be used as a finishing oil. There were someone asking about different olive oils in other regions of the Mediterranean. There is the tahini sauce, which is from sesame seeds, and other ways to have a condiment on your plates, and each one of them has a different taste, flavor, but also a different value under a nutrition point of view.
I'm going to switch over to the question about seafood. In your opinion, what is the role of seafood in the diet? Was seafood regularly consumed by the participants in the study?
In the Nurses Health study, the consumption varied. It was, again, nothing crazy. 1, 2, 3 servings a week. There wasn't anything outrageous about the consumption. And the nurses are representative of the entire U.S. So we have West Coast, East Coast, little. But I actually don't know the type of fish. That I could easily answer some of these questions by email, because I don't actually recall the exact kind of fish that they ate. But it was 1, 2, 3 servings a week.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know Rachel will have these questions on file, and she can, isn't that so, Rachel? You can, anything that isn't answered fully or needs a reference, we can send that out, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. I'm happy to do that. That's not a problem.
Okay, good.
Okay. A couple more questions about olive oil. Just want to see if they stand out. There have been reports of misrepresentation of olive oil from Italy and other countries as extra virgin olive oil when it is mixed with other forms of olive oil and even other oils.
Annie, can you take that?
Yes. Well, there have been, as I mentioned before, there are important, very important trade component in the Mediterranean diet, because it refers specifically to patterns and ingredients coming from abroad. Although, of course, you can have beautiful industry developed here in the U.S. Is just that certain ingredients, certain specific ingredients, are not modified. There are no GMO modified, and the way the manufacturing process of certain products is just better overseas, and there are rooms for, there is the possibility of developing collaborations. This is part of our agenda, so that also in the U.S. you can develop the perfect practice to achieve the same quality performance. That's the case for wine industry, so it's not that it is not possible, it's just that there are certain practices that can benefit of an osmosis. About the scandal with olive oil and not being extra virgin olive oil, it was not specifically that, it was that Italy in particular was affected by an insect that decimated the production, and so the resources resourced to other countries that have a similar production. It is unfortunate. It happens as in most situations in most markets, and it is a part of the MDR agenda to lead the consumers as well as buyers and everybody involved in the food industry to look for certain patterns to recognize a good product. We collaborated with the North American Olive Oil Association for this reason. So it's not that we promote and foster specifically one country. This is much wider. One of the panelists, for instance, is having a comparison between the Mediterranean diet and the Japanese diet to study the same, benefits on the human body. But the way you create, the way you apply the diet, the way you create awareness, rituals, lifestyles, that's what is also important, you know. Otherwise, it would be just a price-driven commerce, and that's, you know, never conducive to healthy choices. So our scope, our role with the Mediterranean diet is to create a platform for discussion to happen and, you know, create an osmosis between the different countries. It is then up to the food industry professionals to get the good from the scientific world, from chefs that are a true inspiration, and apply in everyday choices, especially in food service, commercial and non-commercial food service. And that's the spirit of what we're trying to do.
Okay, I think we have no more time for questions, and I don't see any new ones coming in, so I'll hand it over to Rachel.
Excellent. Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Dr. DeVivo and Daniela. I will summarize the questions and share those out, and we can always do a follow-up to anything that we weren't able to cover in the presentation today. So just a reminder, there'll be a short survey when I close the webinar, and we appreciate your feedback. And then also the email, watch for the email on Friday of this week with the handouts, the recording, and the CEU certificate. And then be sure to check the SNEB website for upcoming presentations, the Journal Club. I think our next webinar, we have two more in this series, I think it's April 24th and May 1st. There is a Hot Topics call that the Higher Education Division is sponsoring that talks about Ascend, and that is on May the 19th. So always look at the website for any upcoming programs, and of course, conference registration is open. I think today marks 100 days until the conference starts, so we will be seeing everyone in Washington, D.C. soon. Thank you again for joining us today.